Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Soupcast, coming to you from ArchaeoSoup Towers. By popular demand, we're taking selected videos from the ArchaeoSoup back catalogue and bringing them to you as convenient podcasts. As the name implies, with ArchaeoSoup, you get a bit of everything thrown into the pot. Archaeology, discussion, humour and debate. You can find out more at ArchaeoSoup.com. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a hearty helping of Archaeo Soup.
Oh, and welcome back to Watching Brief for the week of the 27th of September, 2021. I'm joined this morning by an as ever, industrious and hard-working Mr. Andy Brockman. We're up early so that we can celebrate Mrs. Soup's birthday today. So we're recording a little bit earlier than perhaps we're both comfortable with. We're sort of like newborn puppies blinking in the sunlight, aren't we, Andy?
To coin a phrase that we used elsewhere in a different context, me being up early, it's the 1st of October, so it's a bit of an October surprise.
Exactly. You're like the inverse Buzz It Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog.
Groundhog. Yeah. Actually, it's just stopped doing it. Punxsutawney Phil would have loved it. It's just stopped pissing down here in London. So whether we're in for another 40 days of it, goodness knows. I hope not. It's gloomy enough as it is. But anyway,
indeed. Here we go. Anyway, regardless of how awake we are, our Watching Brief continues, does it not? Our ongoing mission to examine the archaeological news of the week and present it here for you guys for continuing discussion below. And what we should say is that one of the big sort of news stories of the week is with regards to a company called Celtic Films. And we're not ignoring that, but we're saving them for the Muppet of the Month, I think. There's going to be an extra special little something coming out of that story. But also, you know, I mean, as it stands,
we can't. Mark. I have to stop you here. We can't talk about this. We've all been blocked.
Exactly, we have all been blocked. Whether you know it or not, you probably have been blocked, folks at home, by Celtic Films. But we will come to that. Don't worry, we have not missed that story this week. But actually, we're going to start today's Watching Brief with a few news lines. One of them initially actually is relevant to what we were talking about last week with the Dorman Long Tower collapse. Well, sorry. Demolition. It didn't fall down by itself. And this actually has a little hint of irony, doesn't it, Andy?
Irony and goldie and bronzy. Mm. It's a story that broke a few days ago. It involves another demolition of historic industrial heritage.
Yeah.
In this case, it's a place called Stewartby in Bedfordshire. Stewartby was actually named after the family that owned probably one of the biggest brickworks in the country. Mm. The site of the former brickworks is now going to be redeveloped as 1,000 homes and a business park. Mm-hmm. Which is fine. You know, as we've said many times before, archaeologists aren't against change.
And we need homes.
And people need homes. Mm-hmm. However. The issue here was that of the many chimneys that were once part of the brickworks, again, which formed the identity, basically, of this place, four were left, and they have just been basically blown up.
Yeah.
The argument was that they were a potential danger in high winds. There were four of them left. One of them was branded Stewartby with the place name. Mm. The argument was that they were a potential danger in high winds and a potential danger to a railway line that passes nearby. Mm. Historic England said that there was no need for a complete demolition, but the local Get Council gave planning consent for the destruction of the chimneys on the proviso that, quote, a replica was built as part of the new development.
Okay. It's interesting because looking at the one that the main one, the one with Sturtby written on it, that's in the video, for example, on the BBC News article here. There's even a video drone footage of the demolition.
I think we have to stress to our viewer this wasn't done in the middle of the night like the Dorman Long Tower, which they claimed it had to be done at night for safety reasons.
Had to be done at night. On a Sunday morning, had to be done.
Absolutely.
In this instance,
there was absolutely no consideration of the fact that it might have generated, for example, protesters who might turned up and attracted the attention of the TV crews who wouldn't be covering it.
No.
No question of that whatsoever. No.
However, in this instance, this one actually reminds me of a chimney on the site of what is now a Tesco supermarket just up the road from me, in a place called North Shields, where it was a former factory site, as far as I'm aware. Some of the factory buildings are now have been converted into they've recently been reconverted, they've been updated into a series of industrial spaces so people can have garages and workshops in them. But the chimney itself is actually, it's a small local landmark, which the supermarket have taken advantage of. They've actually put the letters for Tesco down the side of the chimney, which is quite cool. So actually, these things can be used in that instance in a highly commercialised way. But also, I imagine that the Stuart B chimney, the reason why they're looking to replace it with a replica, is such an icon that it's going to be probably used as a symbol of the housing estate, if not the town. It continues to be part of the town itself.
Very, very possibly. Anyone that knows Croydon in South London, the IKEA store there, the former factory chimney on that site is actually branded with the IKEA blue and yellow.
Yeah,
and it's a huge marker, and it's an icon for the area.
Is there any sort of irony here in terms of its location and the connection to the Dorman Long Tower?
See what you did there. gentle viewer, you'll understand that we do our prep here, and we do actually structure these apparently meandering chats, because the irony is that the former London Brick Company works at Stuart B in Bedfordshire is in the constituency of our esteemed Culture Secretary Nadine Dorries, whose first action in office was to authorise the delisting and blowing up of the Dorman Long Tower.
Yeah.
So
she loves that
dynamite. I think we're going to have to nickname her Dynamite Doris.
Yes, Dynamite Doris.
We're going to nickname her Dynamite Doris. Dynamite Doris.
I like it. Absolutely. I like it. Let's go with it. Yeah, Dynamite Doris. Next. Yeah, it's bing. It's official. Tick, stamp, approved. Now, along with that story, we've included a link to, and this is a less tall, less potentially wind vulnerable structure, but nonetheless, it's an interesting example of an old structure being kept and restored. And this is from 6 days ago, the story of a public a bathhouse reopened to the public after it was listed in Birkenhead. And it shows that these structures can have.
Do you realise you've just alienated all our viewers' family on Merseyside?
Not entirely. That wasn't a million miles away, and I have family in Birkenhead, so it's fine. It's fine. Okay. I can do that. I'm allowed to offend. These sort of structures, they can have a life after they are decommissioned and listed. And I can think of, again, there are some local examples. There'll be examples like this across the country, especially of old bathhouses, swimming pools and swimming baths. One, for example, that was mentioned when I shared this story on the RKSuit Facebook page was the Durham City swimming pool, the old city swimming pool. I used to walk past it all the time because I used to live beyond it. I used to have to get home when I was going to and from lectures, and it was in use when I was a student. I think since it's become not in use, perhaps, I think. But nonetheless, it was still a very interesting building. And so these things can have a life beyond. And do you think, I suppose, just to end that particular story, do you think that this sort of a site like these chimneys, do you think that the rebuilding a facsimile is enough? Do you think is it okay to do that? And how close do you think that facsimile will have to be? Will they build it as tall? Will they build it brick for brick, forgive the pun?
Yeah. The precedent here is Battersea Power Station, when the redevelopment that's just coming on stream there, it's just that one of the four iconic chimneys was deemed to be in too poor a state to conserve and was demolished. But again, the planning condition that was that it was rebuilt exactly.
Right.
So there is precedent for this. You can make all sorts of arguments that in heritage terms, the rebuilding, making of a facsimile is appropriate. I think it's Upark House in Sussex that burnt down National Trust property was again rebuilt as a facsimile. The really famous one, of course, is the Amber Room in Saskia-Salo, the Summer Palace in St. Petersburg, which was famously stolen by the German army in the Nazis in the invasion of Russia and disappeared in 1945. Right. And it was reproduced exactly by the current Russian government.
It's strange. Obviously, I've heard of that hunt. It's often brought up in these sort of satirically named History Channel documentaries about the hunt for the Amber Room, this kind of thing. But I've never, oddly enough, I've never asked myself how they got footage, colour footage of the Amber Room before, and the answer is that there's a facsimile. I've never connected the two in my mind. I don't know why. I see what you mean, absolutely. So there's a precedent for it, but unless it's a little continuation of Dynamite Doris's explosive
reputation.
Yeah.
Explosive reputation, yeah.
Now, next we come to another government minister, it seems, and he's getting a grilling with regards to the deemed to be twice illegal decision to go ahead with the tunnel development under Stonehenge. I take it that Grant Shapps was given a really hard ride, and he came away with a very slapped wrist, and has to go away and think very carefully about what he's done. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Excellent.
Not.
Oh.
Not.
Oh. No. Okay.
No.
So what happened then?
He was appearing, giving evidence before the House of Commons Transport Select Committee, which is, we've talked about parliamentary select committees before. They're groups of MPs that are allocated on places on the committees are allocated on party lines according to the number of MPs a party has. And they look in more detail at government business, at government activity, at government policy. Mm-hmm. And they're meant to be one of the checks and balances and critical friends that ministers have. Mm. Simon Jupp MP, who's a Conservative MP on the committee, was less a critical friend than a waiter serving up a lovely cocktail of sweetness and delight. Mm. Chaps was asked about by Jupp about the I'll just read the question.
Okay.
The chair of the committee introduced him and said that I know Simon Jupp would like to ask about the A303. And Simon Jupp said, I certainly would. The A303 is a constant source of point of frustration for people in the Southwest and anyone who ever travels in the Southwest, especially during the summer months. A couple of weeks ago, we had the, if I may say so, very disappointing High Court ruling regarding the Stonehenge Tunnel. What's the latest on that? And how much of a setback to the improvement of the A303 that we all want to see is this? You can see he wasn't exactly probing.
No.
Like, Minister, why was your department found to have breached the law twice on the consent order for the Stonehenge Tunnel?
Yeah.
And how much does the delay cost?
Yeah, it was closer to Minister, how inconvenient is it for local people that the law got in the way of your wonderful plan to build a tunnel?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it gets worse. First of all, Shapps was very careful to stay on the right side of the law in this case and not comment in detail on what is still a live planning issue. It's a decision that he now has to remake. Although I think the subtext and the body language was that when he remakes the decision, if he possibly can, unless he's forced into an arm lock by the Treasury and told he can't have the money. I suspect we can predict which way the decision's going to go. Mm-hmm. But he in general terms, he said, they got on to talking about judicial review, and the chair, again, of the Select Committee said, do you think that across government, you and the Ministry of Justice will have to reform the judicial review process? It's the judicial review process that found that the minister had acted unlawfully. Mm. And this is what Shapps said in response. And I think this should ring alarm bells for anybody in the heritage world, and particularly anybody in the heritage world who tries to hold organisations to account, particularly the government to account, mm-hmm. as the Stonehenge Alliance and their colleagues did here. Because what Shapps said was, yes, and now we're not talking about any particular case at all, nudge wink. He said, as I hinted before, the public elect their representatives, many of whom speak up very clearly and vigorously on behalf of their constituents. And that's a pat on the back for Jupp, who asked the dolly drop question. Mm. Ministers make decisions. They do so with the power and authority of Parliament. There has to be a point to which those decisions are able to proceed. I'm concerned that on occasion we allow, as a country, these processes to get tied up in knots where democratically elected people have made perfectly proper decisions that are endlessly questioned and undermined on matters of extreme technicality, costing the taxpayer sometimes hundreds of millions of pounds in delay and frustrating this government's goal to level up the country. So the answer is yes. In other words, the fact that he was found to acted unlawfully over the fate of a World Heritage site was a matter of extreme technicality, his perfectly proper decision wasn't unlawful on two counts.
I see, yes.
That's a really worrying comment.
Yes, I'm just hitting myself in the head with a foam cricket bat there, sorry. I see, so the law is extreme technicality. Interesting, isn't that a lovely way of referring to your bungling of due process when it comes to potentially ruining a World Heritage site. In fact, probably the most famous archaeological site in the world, following the pyramids, maybe. We could wax lyrical about Grant Shapps all day. It's probably worth.
Or Michael Green. To be fair, this time he was appearing as himself, as opposed to the persona he had famously adopted for his online "Make Yourself Rich Quick" schemes, which was Michael Green.
Sorry, I'm just going to just retrieve my cricket bat once more. There we go. Okay, thank you. Michael Green, really? That was his nom de plume or nom de...
He famously adopted an alter ego for a part of his business career, yeah. And denied it for ages until people those mischievous people in the media came up with the proof that Michael Green was indeed Grant Shapps. And vice versa.
But what a gross, extreme technicality that they were drawing on to prove that he was someone else. You know, I mean, these details, man, details. I mean, they're just inconvenient. Ugh, that poor man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So he's much traduced. It's terribly sad.
Anyway. Let's move on to our main headline this week, and that is that the British Museum is breaking into new worlds, new ventures, new exciting realms of possibilities by creating so-called NFTs, non-fungible tokens of artwork that it holds in its collection. In this instance, the work of Katsushika Hokusai, most famously known for a selection of prints produced for a 19th century encyclopedia, the most famous of which is the Wave, have been put up for sale in this new digital format, following what appears to have been a, quote, cold message on LinkedIn. The CEO of a French company called La Collection messaged the British Museum, who apparently are up for cold messages. Maybe we should try sending a random message to them and proposing how they can make money.
Actually, that's a good point. I already talked to their press office quite a bit.
This cold message suggesting that they created NFTs of works in their collection. Prices are set to start around $500 for what they are calling postcards. This also comes in the context of back in March, an NFT by the digital artist Mike Winkleman selling for $69.4 million. So you can almost hear the ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching going off in someone's head at the British Museum to monetize, further monetize, I should say, elements of their collection. Now, the immediate response online was quite passionate, shall we say. Some people were very...
No. I think you need to be clear. Most people dumped all over it.
Yes. Yes, they did. Yes. No, they did dump all over it, because this is...
Most people in the Twitter sphere dumped all over it.
This is barefaced profiteering, and I think that the one of the most hilarious aspects of this, though, is the pretense that it is making the artwork available to new, exciting audiences. It is so important, said Craig Bendel, licensing manager at the British Museum, that as a museum we continually adapt to new markets. New markets? What markets? And find new ways of reaching people that we may not reach through traditional channels, because Hokusai's work really needs NFTs in order to reach those people who haven't been made aware of one of the most iconic prints in human history. That's what we need. We need NFTs that start at $500 so that people can share a link to an image with their friends. Yes.
Shall I put the other point?
Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm kicking the bat away from me. I don't want to hurt myself, so I'm just gonna put it over there.
dear viewer, it is one of those weeks. I'm not an art historian, although obviously, like probably pretty much everybody out there, the Hokusai, the Great Wave, is one of the most iconic images in the world. It's reproduced endlessly. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. It's elegant. It's exciting.
It's also played with. I mean, I shared with you yesterday a photo of an image I have just up there on my office wall, which is a version of Hokusai's Wave with elements from the Legend of Zelda computer game inserted into it. So it's well known. It's parodied. It's played with. It's beloved. It's a foundational image for much of Eastern and Western iconography and graphic design.
And to be fair to the BM and La Collection, they're not just digitizing and turning into a non-fungible token. Again, what an awful blooming name! It sounds like a non-fungible token is something you can't grow mushrooms on.
non-fungible token. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
They are digitizing many other Hokusai works, Hokusai prints.
Yeah.
But the clue is in the word prints. These things exist elsewhere.
Yeah.
In more than one copy, in many cases. But I'm not an art historian, somebody who is Dr. Bendel Grosvenor, who many people will know from his work on TV series like Forgotten Masterpieces. And he has.
That's him. So now I know who he is. Yes.
Britain's Lost Masterpieces.
Yeah.
He's a recognised art historian, he has been waging a personal campaign against the monetization of public collections in the art world for some time now. And I'll come on to that in a minute, but his immediate reaction on Twitter to the non-fungible, those things that the British Museum is going to be turning out, is, quote, "This is desperate, please don't fall for it. And at British Museum, if you really want to, quote, democratize art and attract a younger audience, end quote, then don't ask them to pay for what they already own." His particular beef is that, for example, public collections like the British Museum, in this case, or the National Gallery or the National Portrait Gallery, will charge a fortune in, quote, reproduction rights for images from their collections, which the public already own. And he argues this has a particularly damaging effect on, for example, professional art criticism and research, because it prevents particularly newly established early career art historians from publishing in certain areas, because they simply can't afford the reproduction rights, which can run into hundreds of pounds or more. He makes the point that on TV programs that he works on, they restrict the use of certain images because they can't afford what the galleries are asking.
So it can run to the hundreds of pounds per instance of the use of
an image. And more if you're talking about electronic media, about television and so on.
Because it's easily reproducible and broadcastable. Absolutely,
and it's a mass audience.
Isn't that the mass audience that they're desperate to reach, though?
That's the argument. Absolutely. I do urge people. We'll post the link to Ben de Grosvenor's Twitter thread on this, because it is beautiful. Another thing he says is that, when I was an art dealer, the snooty pomposity from nationals like the British Museum when it came to, quote, the trade, i.e. the art trade, was endless. But now they think that when they think they can make a few quid, they're jumping into a market in the most polluting and morally dubious way possible. And I think it's also worth saying here that, you know, these non-fungible tokens exist digitally. They exist as a link. Yeah. And the point's been made in a number of cases here that there's no guarantee that having paid you hundreds of dollars or whatever for your non-fungible token, that link will last as long as the Hokusai print, which is 200 years old.
Well, yeah, there's a DRM, or digital rights management, issue here. In the realm of, for example, computer games, I've certainly lost purchases by only having bought them digitally. Rights are lost for the library to host them, and the game no longer exists. I ended up recently, when a game became available physically, because of this issue, actually. It was a fairly famous example. It was the Scott Pilgrim versus the World computer game. I bought the physical edition because the digital one did disappear. But also, as you touch on there is an environmental cost as well. According to Earth.org, I'll just read this little paragraph here. "It is difficult to estimate the carbon footprint of minting an NFT, because many steps in the process do not have a known carbon footprint, and there are a few scientific peer-reviewed studies on this topic. However, it has been estimated that the carbon footprint of an NFT can be between 33.4 and 48 kilograms of CO2 per transaction. For example, to put that into context, it's approximately 14 times the cost of mailing an art print in terms of environmental impact. So if I was shipping an art print from me to you, or presumably me across the world to the US, as I sometimes do, in fact, that still wouldn't have the same impact as a single NFT being produced, because these are computerized, mathematically determined pieces of code that can't be faked because of the complex mathematics involved in them. and that takes up computing power. So they're involved in this new market, which has a questionable future in terms of digital rights management. They're involved in this new market that has questionable credentials in terms of the environment. But also, as well, isn't there an interesting angle coming in from the European Union on this, Andy?
There is. Mm. And that is a new European copyright directive, which would appear to make copyright free a work that involves no creative input. Mm. In other words, if you exactly reproduce something, which is what these non-fungible tokens of the Hokusai appear to claim to be, if you simply reproduce what an artist has created previously from a museum collection,
for example, in a book. So if you're trying to just show the art,
in a book, yes? Absolutely. For example, in an art book or a journal of record. Mm-hmm. The outside of the copyright expired items can't then be copyrighted. Mm. Can't then be they become copyright free. Mm. So for example, and the example's been cited, but if you went to the Louvre and took an exact took a photograph of the Mona Lisa and didn't play around with it in Photoshop, the Louvre couldn't come after you. Yeah. Because you've made no creative input. The creative input was made by Leonardo da Vinci in the early 1500s.
Yeah.
Late 1400s, yeah. Where I come up with the exact date of the Mona Lisa. Presumably
there's going to be an area there in between, because you can also have a transformative element, can't you? So if you fully transform an image, it moves beyond copyright. So that
there are already exemptions which exploit very often for parody and comment.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
As well.
So that there's, but nonetheless, the point being though, it's probably going to be easier to get hold of an image from a European museum at certainly far less cost, depending on how you acquire it, than from the British Museum. And that's before
or the National Gallery, Portrait Gallery, or any of the other museums and galleries that act in this way. Yes.
Yeah, and that's before we take into account the extra costs, environmental and economic, and in terms of uncertainty of NFTs. It's short-sighted, it seems, from such a apparently venerable institution.
Yeah, I mean the argument is that by carrying on down, and it's not just about the NFTs, it's about the general attitude to their archives, that they're a resource to be exploited rather than a resource to be shared with the public that already owns them. And that goes to a fundamental question of how do we fund our museums and galleries, and there has been a move to see them as businesses that act in exploiting new markets, absolutely. We have to ask, is that what we want? To be fair to them, the major British museums and galleries are still free to enter.
Yes.
But obviously that's a limited audience, the people that can get there physically.
But that's also a very different argument from suggesting that you're trying desperately to make this art available to new and hitherto unreached audiences.
Yes.
If that's what I mean. So if they were saying, look, we're doing this because we want to keep the museum open for everyone for free forever, I might just about understand why they're doing it, as opposed to just seeing them see dollar signs.
Absolutely. Look, I think just to wind this up, this venture has been pretty much panned across the board. I mean, another name that people will recognise, historian and art critic Simon Sharma, just tweeted, terrible idea. Mm. And our colleague David Petz from Durham University tweeted out, if the British Museum is serious about democratising and increasing access to its collections, it needs to stop its absolutely gouging reproduction fees for everything except the most narrowly academic publications.
Yes.
It's not just artworks, it's pieces from the archaeological record, from the archaeological archive of the British Museum as well, we're talking about here. So, you know,
I know that David often works, for example, in the realm of Anglo-Saxon sculpture, for example, this kind of thing. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think, you know, bottom line, and that's what we're talking about here, the bottom line, what we've got is the British Museum speculating on a new fad in the art market, which might be gone by this time next year because there'll be another one.
Yeah.
And another, you know, another way of parting people perhaps with too much money from some of their too much money.
Yeah.
Because we're not, you know, they call these things postcards. Your normal postcard, you know, £1.50 or whatever. These things, we're talking about hundreds of dollars, hundreds of pounds. And you have to ask why. We put it this way. I think the whole thing is put in perspective by Bendel Grosvenor's final tweet in his thread, which we will share below. And he just writes, P.S. Here's a high res for free over a copy of the Hokusai Wave.
Yeah, absolutely. The image is available for free because it's out.
Yeah.
Yeah, the artist copyright. Yeah. It is, in fact, the link of the week. So we'll have it available below. I suppose, that is quite rightly an end point there. But if you don't mind, can I just add a little bit more to it? Just a little bit. In so much as this feels like a little bit like with proprietary file technology and other ways of sort of keeping the mechanism of access to otherwise available material within the boundaries and the purview of a particular company so they can profit from it. This feels like, for many, and it has been observed, that it's another way that capitalism is trying to hold on to the relationship between going to a coal mine and getting some coal, buying the physical coal, and then turning that into something, you know, using it to heat some ore and smelting iron or something. The fact that Apple can take music that's available in an MP3 and turn it into an MP4 so it only plays on their phones is a symptom of the need to somewhat artificially control and therefore create a sort of scarcity or create a currency in the literal sense of the word, I suppose, around certain digital artifacts which are otherwise freely and endlessly copy and pastable. And so it's I can see why for some people it's so intangible that they just say this is a terrible idea, but it's also a symptom of where we're at in our economic system at the moment. People are trying to hold on to elements of economic control that previously were held by people who literally owned the factory in which something was built. That's no longer the case when you can literally copy and paste something automatically thousands, hundreds of thousands of times. But the other thing as well to bear in mind, and we've got a link here to a review of the exhibition that's currently underway. It opened yesterday on the 30th of September and is open until the 30th of January next year. Hokusai, the Great Picture Book of Everything, is an exhibition which is available for access in the British Museum. And even though they're selling prints or postcards of Hokusai's prints for $500 upwards, in fact, you have to also pay £11 per adult to access the exhibition. So actually, they're not subsidising access. They are also profiting from access to the exhibition as well. So exhibition access is a paid access, even though it's a publicly owned collection. Copying the image and putting it in a book is a paid process, even though it's a publicly owned collection. And now you can also buy an NFT of, which may in a few years' time be the MySpace of digital properties for $500 plus of an image which is owned in a publicly owned collection. And also, as I say, referencing the image on my wall, is also part of a internationally known basic library of graphical touchstone imagery. It's people dancing around and finding ways of manipulating ideas of ownership. I find this both fascinating and also a little bit tragic. I'll let you have a final word if you want.
Since you've gone into this particular area, I would widen it out just a little bit, actually. The whole issue of the reproduction of material, obviously, it's hedged around with some very complex law. That, you know, there are very highly trained lawyers and entire law firms that specialise in media law and reproduction rights and licensing and so on. It's an incredibly complex area internationally. Mm-hmm. What I would say, though, is that I think bringing it back to the individual researcher, individual artist, individual writer, as we may have mentioned before, I was involved in publishing a book last year. And as part of that contract, my co-author Tracy Spate and I were responsible for supplying the illustrations. Now, not a lot of people might not be aware that when you pick up a book, when you pick up a hardback with its standard sort of 18 pages of pictures, 18 pictures rather, that those pictures haven't been paid for by the publisher, they've been paid for by the author, by and large. And unless you're the kind of person that can demand whose agent can demand a contract whereby the publisher pays for everything. We were faced with, for example, an allocation of 18 images for the book, which we had to supply. You go to the commercial agencies, and I'm not naming them because they're particularly guilty. I'm just naming them because they're one of the most high profile, and that's Getty, the Getty Archive, where you go for a lot of historical 20th century imagery. It was simply beyond our budget. We would have blown our entire advance and more had we provided images from commercial archives. That's how serious it is. And you don't get paid much in the first place. For most nonfiction these days. Let alone academic, you know, before we get onto academic publishing. So there are serious issues, because a lot of those images in the Getty Archive, for example, are from newspapers which are now out of copyright.
Yes.
So if you go to the newspaper, if you buy a copy of the original newspaper, you can actually reproduce an image, and in fact, a lot of historical authors do that. I've done it myself. I used to write for a certain military history magazine, and I'd hope I might write them again. But on those occasions, I'd actually make more from the images I supplied as part of the commission than I did on the wordage.
Yes. Yeah.
So. And the way I was able to do that was, I've got a collection of out of copyright books where the photographs are all sort of orphan works. There are some things some photographs you can't technically use, because if the photographer is named and they died within the last 75 years, then technically it remains their copyright. Well, it might remain their copyright, depends on what the contract was with the publisher. And then we get into that really complex area of law again.
But that's an interesting example, in so much as what you're describing there. If you find the image in the original newspaper that's out of copyright, you essentially are on the same trading level then as Getty, in that sense. You're interacting with the image at the same point as Getty is, and if you wanted you could go on to sell that image. It's a strange world.
It's a very strange world. It's a complex world. It's a morally complex and ambiguous world. But I think the thing that is clear, and I'm absolutely with Endor Grosvenor on this, is that I don't think that public collections should exploit particularly academic authors who are trying to share works with the public and explain them and so on.
Otherwise, what is the point of a publicly held collection if not for public good?
Precisely. Yeah. You can argue, why should somebody going to see a picture, online, a good quality copy of an image online, have to and share it? Why should they have to pay when the public already owns it?
Exactly. Well, technically, they already own it if they're a citizen of this
Exactly.
of this country. Yeah,
that's the point. Exactly. Yeah.
Or it's certainly owned on their behalf. Well, we have gone slightly over our intended time slot here, but I knew this would happen because the NFT British Museum topic was such an interesting one and quite meaty. So there was plenty to discuss there. Hopefully you guys have enjoyed this at home. Please do add to this conversation below. We haven't even touched on the fact that for example, it's difficult producing, say, medium to long size, large size documentaries and putting them out on YouTube, because they can be freely viewed, freely downloaded, freely copied as well. So in that sense, that's something that both Andy and I are operating within that realm. And therefore, what is the value of that work as well? There's all these, you know, in so much as, again, relating to this notion of literal capital in that economic system. It's an interesting one. I'm sure it's something that we're going to return to at some point in the future, but we'll leave it there for today. Thank you for your time this morning, Andy. I'm going to go away now and well, quickly edit this and then enjoy the rest of Mrs. Soup's birthday. Until next time, guys, do take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, and happy birthday to Mrs. Soup.
Happy birthday, Andy.
This podcast episode has been produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network in collaboration with ArchaeoSoup Productions. Find out more podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.